Find our errant members as we get going. We don't have a quorum, but we do have enough members to open up a public hearing. I am opening up a public hearing on House Bill 4011. Administrator, will you tell us what we're doing here?
Mr. Co-Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 4011 was introduced as an interim committee, health care committee bill. It requires a person convicted of driving while under the influence of intoxicants to submit proof that that person completed the required treatment program before reinstatement of the driving privileges. This authorizes the Department of Transportation to provide exceptions for good cause. This particular bill is a temporary fix, and it has a sunset clause of January 2nd, 2014. It also has an emergency clause.
Mr. Co-Chair, do you want to make an opening statement on this one?
Yes. Okay. I'm going to make it very short. With two issues on the table here. Number one, this is a, hate the word, Band-Aid. It's a technical fix to a problem that was identified in the present system by the Attorney General on what the DOII people can and cannot do. This fixes that problem in the temporary. The larger issue of the DUII work group on what we're going to do about reorganizing DUII and bringing some unification to it is still in progress. We won't get that till 2013. So this is just a technical fix that satisfies the Attorney General in response to what the people processing these certificates can and cannot do at present. But it is not the greater DUII problem fix. That was clear as mud, wasn't it?
No, it was really clear. I just lost a piece of my list here. So, is there still somebody on the list? Can I have Amy Joyce please join us?
If I didn't know she was here, I wouldn't have said anything.
This makes sense.
I can't you just have a public hearing and then move the bill.
Chair Greenlick, Chair Thompson, members of the committee, my name is Amy Joyce. I'm from the Department of Transportation representing the DMV, passing out some written testimony. But Chair Thompson gave an excellent overview of the situation. DMV for some 20 years has required people before their license is reinstated after a DUII conviction to prove that they've completed the drug or alcohol treatment required under the law. Recently, just last year, DOJ informed DMV that the statutory authority for that administrative rule was somewhat questionable due to statutes changing over the years. DMV filed to repeal that rule, and at the request of Chairs Greenlick and Thompson and also the House Judiciary Co-Chairs Krieger and Barker, suspended the repeal so that the legislature could have an opportunity to fix the problem. And that is why we have House Bill 4011 that does three things. Grants clear statutory authority for DMV to continue this practice of requiring that proof of treatment before reinstating the driver license after a DUI conviction. It also gives clear authority to DMV to create some exceptions to that requirement for situations where it just doesn't really make sense to hold firm to that requirement. And thirdly, does sunset it in January of 2014 to allow Chair Thompson's DUII work group to look at issues like should the driver license be held up as the carrot or stick for treatment? Is DMV the appropriate entity to be enforcing that, or perhaps the judiciary or some other agency? So it's a temporary fix and allows DMV to continue doing the practice it's done for some 20 years.
Great. Are there any questions? Yes, sir. Oh, Rep. Doherty.
Yes.
I was looking for that hand in the...
Yep.
There were two, I think.
Many people have think, yes, Representative Conklin are twins, but no. I notice on here that...
The older twin.
Yeah. She's a better looking twin.
Yeah, I was wondering about the appearance. Yes.
Is the completion of a DHS-approved alcohol and whatever... Are there many programs that are not DHS approved, or I'm just wondering about a program in maybe in the rural areas that
co-chairs
going to be a problem if it's not DHS.
Co-chairs and Representative Doherty, To be honest, I don't know where the locale is of those that are and are not DHS approved. DHS has a set of standards, as I understand it, that a program either qualifies or they do not. I'm not aware that it's a geographic problem, and again, this has been on the books for many years. I'm not aware that there's a geographic problem with that.
So maybe more information down the road as to what are DHS-approved drug and alcohol programs would be helpful for me.
Chairs and Rep. Doherty, I will do what I can to get that to you.
Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you very much. Oh, I'm sorry.
Hi, how are you? Sorry, we were out in the hall. We were a few minutes late to school. So question on kind of unintended consequences of how do you prevent people when they're getting treatment to, from slipping through the cracks and making sure that if you're giving exceptions that they actually are really doing what they need to be doing? And I mean, I have a sister who died of drug addictions and had significant DMV issues, and treatment was always kind of one of those things that we just, you know, never quite got through any one treatment program, and suddenly we have a driver's license and then we're back to driving while suspended, and the list kind of goes on and on. And so I'm just kind of curious how you handle people like that in the system.
Co-chairs and Representative Parrish, in terms of the exceptions, DMV has already drafted a proposed administrative rule that would line out, you know, what some exceptions would look like, and we've distributed that to various stakeholders, DHS, the Judicial Department, the Governor's Advisory Committee on DUII, to get feedback on what exceptions would look like. Right now, and I have copies of that draft rule if anybody's interested.
I would like to get a copy of that. That'd be great.
Absolutely. Discussed even just before this hearing with representatives of DHS and the treatment providers, so we could go over some of the fixes that they'd like to see. So those conversations are ongoing. The idea being that there would be a significant period of time after the DUI conviction, many years, proof that an evaluation has been done, and some kind of information that folks have taken steps. Let me just give you an example, if I may. Currently under DHS rules, as I understand it, inpatient treatment is not approved for to meet the standard for this. So somebody could go to a very reputable and excellent inpatient treatment, but based on DHS's understanding of addictions, et cetera, those are not acceptable. Folks have come to us, and they're 10 years after their DUII. They've done inpatient treatment. Maybe they come with their AA sponsor, and they're, you know, 8 years clean and sober, and without the certificate from the proper kind of treatment, DMV's hands are tied. So
what it's thought was one of my constituents who had been treated in an inpatient facility on the East Coast, one of the nation's best known, came back clean and sober many, many years, and went to get his license reinstated, and DMV wanted to reinstate it, but they didn't have the authority to do it because that wasn't one of their registered programs. Okay. Close the public hearing on House Bill 4011 and open a work session on House Bill 4011. We have a motion.
Chair Greenlech, I move House Bill 4011 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Thompson moves House Bill 4011 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Yes.
Is there any discussion? Call the roll, please.
Representative Conger?
Aye.
Representative Doherty?
Aye.
Representative Kenny Geyer?
Aye.
Representative Perry?
Aye.
Vice Chair Hoyle?
Aye.
Vice Chair Kenmer?
Aye.
Co-Chair Thompson?
Aye.
Co-Chair Green? Look.
Aye. Whatever his name is. Motion passes. President Thompson, would you like to carry this?
I would be delighted.
Okay, we have a carrier. Close the work session on House Bill 4011 and open the work session on House Bill 4009, which has been carried over. We didn't have all the paperwork. We now do have all the paperwork. Do you want to describe this bill to us, please?
I do, Mr. Co-Chair. Members of the committee, we heard the bill on Wednesday, February 1st. Sorry, we had a stranger walk into our minutes.
Oh, okay.
House Bill 4009 was the bill that eliminates the monitoring entity program from the impaired health professional program.
One monitoring.
Excuse me?
It eliminates one monitoring program. There are two.
Right, the monitoring entity from the program. There's no revenue impact. There is a fiscal statement, but it just outlines where the savings will occur with the elimination of the expense to the monitoring entity. You recall that you did adopt the Dash 1 amendment on Wednesday, February 1st.
Do we have a motion on that one?
Chair Greenlich, I move to adopt. Chair Greenlich, I move House Bill 4009 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Thompson moves House Bill 4009 to the floor as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Please call the roll.
Representative Conger.
Aye.
Representative Doherty.
Aye.
Representative Keeney-Dyer.
Aye.
Representative Parrish.
Aye.
Vice Chair Hoyle.
Aye.
Vice Chair Kinnamer.
Aye.
Co-Chair Thompson.
Aye.
Co-Chair Greenlich.
Aye. Motion carries. House Bill 4009 is on the way to the floor with the, as amended with a due pass recommendation. Do we have a volunteer to carry it? Representative Hoyle will be the carrier. Oh, okay. Close the work session on House Bill 4009. I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 4011. House Bill 4164. The purpose, we're not going to work that bill today. We're going to carry it over till Monday and work it on Monday, but we didn't finish the public hearing on that bill, so we had two people left over from last time, and we still three left over from last time. Can we invite them up? And that would be Jan Meekum, Betsy Earls, Rocky, and Amy, the dynamic duo. And let's start with Jan Meeker, Betsy Earls, and Mike Becker. And then if we need any cleanup hitters.
Mr. Becker is en route, and I'll try to get him to show up in a moment or two.
Okay, yeah, we'll keep moving forward. Keep an eye out for him.
Thank you.
Should we move this on a little bit?
Give it to the assistant, please.
You want to? I wonder whether we just ought to move on to the next public hearing. Let's do that, and we'll give people a chance to get it. I can keep this open, is that right?
Sure.
And open another bill. Let's do which one do you want to do now? All right, well, let's go for it.
Yeah.
Let's open up a public hearing. We'll open a public hearing on House Bill 4010. Madam Administrator, what is this thing?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 4010 was also introduced at the request of the interim House Healthcare Committee. It requires the insurers to reimburse nurse practitioners at the same rate as physicians for the same services, declares an emergency effective on passage. It has no revenue, and the impact statement got put in everybody's file late, but I do have hard copies in case you need that. But it outlines that for the Oregon Health Authority as well as Department of Consumer and Business Services, fiscal impact will be minimal and or indeterminate.
Okay.
And I'm not...
And who we...
You can start with Jack.
Jack, would you like to introduce us? Susan, are you going to join us in this?
And I believe... There's somebody on the phone, but I'm not sure if they called in. Okay, we've got to hop in.
We have a nice long list. I'm going to ask you all to keep your testimony to a minimum.
Good afternoon, Chair Greenlick and Co-Chair Thompson and members of the committee. My name is Susan King. I'm the Executive Director of the Oregon Nurses Association. We've been before you several times in the past talking about this issue, which in its simplest explanation would require that insurers pay nurse practitioners the same as they do physicians when the service is the same. And I want to make sure that I emphasize when the service is the same as determined by the codes which the carriers and providers use to describe the diagnoses and the service provided. As we've talked to you about before, we have met with providers, provider business representatives, and the insurers over the last several months. And as best we can explain it to you is there are a variety of ways that providers are paid. In many cases, in the vast majority of cases in the state of Oregon, for private insurance, nurse practitioners are paid the same as physicians. That is the policy of some of the major carriers. It's not the policy of others. In some cases, we know that nurse practitioners and physicians might be paid differently across town from each other. Nurse practitioners in large practices enjoy a different reimbursement rate. So I think the term I've used before is that the reimbursement practices of insurers, though they might be based on codes, are extremely variable, and the impact on that variability for access to services in some cases is pretty significant. I'm going to close with saying that this bill is a fix for our current healthcare delivery system. I think we're all hoping that we transform this system into something much better in the future. So we recognize that this is not, hopefully, a problem that will last forever, but it is a remedy that we need. We also know that this bill will affect a small subset of Oregon nurse practitioners, probably 200 or less, who engage in their own independent private practice. The vast majority of nurse practitioners currently in Oregon, and is becoming rapidly true for physicians, is that they are in large practices where there are combinations of providers. So we don't believe that this is going to affect every one of the approximately 2,500 nurse practitioners in the state. I'll close there and defer to my colleagues, and we'll be very happy to answer questions for you.
I'll be brief. Jack Dempsey with the Oregon Nurses Association. So you do have three documents in front of you that I'll reference. One is a one-pager from our organization. There is also a letter from various physicians around Oregon in support of this. There's about 18 or so names on there. By no means is we only have support from 18 physicians in the state, but these are the few we could get our hands on in the last couple months. And then the last page is a coalition letter that has some other groups that support this.
Thank you.
Co-Chair Greenlick and Co-Chair Thompson and members of the committee, it's an honor to be back here again. Some of you may have remember that we visited last year and even the year before that on similar
Please
measures.
Introduce yourself.
Oh, I'm sorry. You know, the first time I came in, you reminded me of that as well. I don't learn very well. I am Linda Morley. I'm a psychiatric mental health nurse practitioner in private practice in Salem. The reason this has been such a concern is that we have, as nurse practitioners, experienced a pretty significant decrease in reimbursement rates from private insurers. I do want to be very clear, too. I think that in some areas there's a misunderstanding about this bill. The only thing, as I understand it, that this bill will impact is private insurers' reimbursement rates to licensed professionals. So this doesn't affect any other kind of public health care. One of the things, just very briefly, because I know you have access to my previous testimony and what is already provided for you is very inclusive. When I was getting ready to do my taxes this year, and knowing that my income had decreased pretty significantly last year and the year before because of these reimbursement cuts. And so one of the things that I did this last year was to try to put together more hours in the office to just work harder because I had already been working smarter. So I increased my patient load by 21%. I didn't aim for 21%. I just started taking more patients and spending more time. In the last 2 years, my income
has decreased by 22%, even though I increased the number of hours that I see patients. One of the things that I'm personally very concerned about is that even though these cuts began with those of us who are in psychiatric and mental health care, they're now being seen across the board with all nurse practitioners who take private insurance. And that's all I have for right now, but we'd be happy to answer any questions or explain.
Are there any questions? Yes, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just wanted to clarify, there are a variety of different types of nurses and specialties and all kinds of things, including evidently within nurse practitioner. But anyone who is licensed as a nurse practitioner, those are the only people to whom this bill would apply, and even then, only those essentially in private practice.
That's correct.
Just wanted to confirm that.
Okay. Well, I believe some of them what might be in group practices, but we're receiving commercial reimbursement.
As long as they are a nurse practitioner and licensed as such,
yes,
this bill applies only to them, not to specialty nurses, not to other designated types of nurses. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Can I ask a question?
Oh, sure.
So, thank you, Mr. Chair. Susan, you talked about 200 affected out of the 2,500. Could you explain that?
Yes, co-chairs and Representative Kenny Geyer. That's our best estimate, and it's probably a little generous. Approximately 2,500 to 2,600 nurse practitioners are certified in the state of Oregon. Again, the vast majority work in multi-provider practices. And in the independent private practice where a nurse practitioner might hone her own clinic, we think that number is 200 or less. We don't have hard data because we can't always track who's in that particular segment of the industry.
So this would not affect the 2,300 or so that are in group practice, is that right?
Co-chairs and Representative Kenny Geyer. Again, it is hard to give you one answer because the let me give you an example that might be illustrative of the question. I met with the business manager for a large women's health care practice in the city of Portland. And he's a pretty good negotiator, I'm sure, because he negotiates the same rate for the same service, and I'll continue to underscore that, whether that service is provided by a nurse practitioner or a physician. There are many services where the physicians are providing something that the nurse practitioners wouldn't, such as, you know, conducting and completing a C-section. They recently took in a private practice across the river, merged with or purchased, and discovered that the reimbursement rate for both physicians and nurse practitioners in that other clinic was significantly lower than theirs. So the way that reimbursement is determined is completely variable, but in that instance, he is able to negotiate equal payment. So I think it depends on the conditions of that clinic. If they have a business manager who's skilled at negotiations, this probably won't be an issue. And again, some of the carriers report that their practice and their policy is that they reimburse the same for the same services.
Thank you.
I'm sorry?
Kenner and Conger.
Is that Kenner?
Was that a fusion of
Kenner?
Whoever goes first wins.
I have seniority.
And Representative Paris.
Oh, I'm not on the list. I was just pointing down the hall.
Okay. No,
thank you, Mr. Chair. In the explanation, Ms. King, you mentioned certified, and I see in the language here that nurse practitioners are apparently certified and licensed. I'm sorry, this is a distinction that has escaped me, and how does that process work then? The state licensure, who does the certification? Is that from the training programs or what? I'm at a loss.
Co-chairs and Representative Kennemer, that's my mistake. I spent time on the Board of Nursing, and so I have that lingo in my brain, so
okay.
I apologize. Nurse practitioners are, in fact, licensed by the Oregon State Board of Nursing. Additionally, they are certified in their category of practice. For example,
by the board? Certified by?
They're required to be nationally certified.
That's what I thought.
Right.
Okay, thank you.
I'm sorry for that confusion.
Yeah, just needed to understand.
Senator Conger?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I've talked to Jack about this. I have some questions about the bill, things that I don't understand or the bill is not very clear on. And so if the chair will indulge me with a couple of questions, I'll just kind of walk through them and,
please,
and hopefully.
Carry on.
Thank you. So the first is, in my community, I am under the impression, and I'm nearly certain this is true, that different doctors negotiate different contracts with the same insurer. So you can have a doctor practicing a couple of blocks away from another doctor, and they may be reimbursed at a different rate for the same billing codes. In fact, again, I'm nearly certain this is true. So when we talk about, when the bill talks about reimbursing at the same reimbursement paid under a policy to a licensed physician performing the service in the area served, it's not clear which physician we would be comparing to. So if different doctors are getting paid different amounts, how would you expect that to get resolved?
Co-chairs and Representative Conger, one way to look at it could be geographic area, because we know certainly costs are different in one area of Portland than another. The bill is not specific about that, and that certainly would be something that we'd want to further define in rule, should we succeed in getting your approval for this bill. But I guess it would be unclear to us why two physicians in your area providing the same service as defined by the codes, which is the best measure that we have at this point, would be paid differently. And I think that illustrates the conditions that we're finding is it's a matter of negotiation, not service provided or outcomes, that's determining the reimbursement rates.
I actually believe that that's true, and I think it needs more consideration to determine whether or not we should interfere with that negotiation process. Along the same lines, I don't know this, but if an insurer has negotiated with a, let's say it's a clinic, for a set of reimbursement rates, I assume that there's some contractual obligation that arises to pay those reimbursement rates for some period of time. So this bill, and this is a pet peeve of mine, by the way, has an emergency clause. As attorneys, keeping up with the emergency clauses going into effect is actually puts us as at malpractice risk. But if the bill were to pass, what would happen if there was how do insurers change those reimbursement rates? Do they have contracts? Do they have a methodology to change them? What would happen?
Co-chairs and Representative Conger, I'm going to go out on a limb here. First of all, I'm not an attorney, so I'm not an expert at contracts. But it isn't completely clear to me. There are certainly carriers in the room that can give you more specific information, but let me give you an example. We recently spoke with one of our colleagues who has an independent clinic. It's a rural health clinic, as a matter of fact. And she received a letter that simply said, this will be your reimbursement rate for the next year. So there wasn't any negotiation, and there wasn't any rationale provided. And so I would assume that since insurers have had the freedom to make arbitrary decisions before this bill, should it pass, that they would be able to find a way to rationalize those payments if the bill does pass. And secondarily, the reason, of course, that it's an issue is that it matters to access. If the providers aren't able to stay in business while we're making this transition, and we certainly know in primary care our capacity is insufficient as it is in mental health care, then, you know, the business arrangements ought to rapidly, in our opinion, be remedied so that we don't end up with a lack of access or providers leaving practice.
I appreciate that answer. And by the way, I'll raise that same. If we have the opportunity to hear from carriers during the hearing, I would ask the same question of them. Definitely didn't want to put you on the spot. Not intended to be a trick question. Another question I had as I read the bill, and by the way, I like it because it's short and simple. It doesn't, it's not particularly hard to read, but this isn't actually part of the bill, but this is part of the existing statute, and I just wanted to ask, it excludes from this provision, already and as amended, health maintenance organizations. They're federally qualified. Why is that?
Co-chairs and Representative Conger, that's quite an old historic relic, I will say, in the statute. And at the time that my organization asked for that language to be enacted by the legislature, there was a discussion and a compromise with one of the major HMOs, and that was Kaiser Permanente. And they believed that with respect to reimbursing for providers, that they had a different model, a salary-based model, and that they should be excluded from the statute at that time. That's my best recollection because that's about 25 years or more ago.
I have one more question, if I may, Mr. Chair.
Go for it.
Thank you. So, related question, and again, I discussed this with Jack earlier today, as a matter of fact. So, to be clear, many nurse practitioners work in a clinical setting. They're not owners of the practice, and therefore, they won't realize any benefit from personally from this bill. In other words, in the example we used, I won't use a specific example we used, but a doctor's office where the doctor employs a nurse practitioner, so the doctor or the owner of the clinic or the practice will actually receive the benefit, not the nurse practitioner, if the bill goes into effect. And relatedly, that is a cost inflator for the healthcare system, potentially. It could also deflate doctor reimbursement rates. So I understand that's the other option, but it's either a cost inflator or it drives down other provider reimbursement rates as a result of this, one or the other. It was really two separate questions, but I was trying to sneak it in because I told the chairman I only had one more.
Co-chairs and Representative
Conger.
You can have
any number you want.
I was waiting for a question mark or a period somewhere in there.
It became an incredible run-on sentence. Yeah, so if you can answer any of that.
Thank you, and I'm not an English teacher either. Let me do my best to take apart the elements of your question.
Good question.
So where a nurse practitioner or a physician is an employee of a practice, you're correct. That practice, should this bill pass, would realize a difference in reimbursement because
if it was paid on a fee-for-service basis.
That's right, under a fee-for-service arrangement because that provider is still filling out a code sheet or entering it into an electronic health record, and that becomes the basis for reimbursement for that visit or that service. And then whether or not that nurse practitioner or physician is able to negotiate a better salary, sometimes they do because many large systems are using some relative value measures for how they base compensation for their providers.
Sure, there could be a bonus system.
Sure, that's very common, salary plus a relative value bonus of some sort. With respect to the cost inflation question, and I know that this is an answer that's frequently given to questions about this bill, is that if this happens, then healthcare costs will rise. And I would just like to raise the issue about if this doesn't pass and providers continue to see significant reimbursement reductions, 25% in some cases, then should the person paying the premium for that service enjoy some sort of a discount as well? To our knowledge, and we may not have that data, I'm not aware that any of the insurers give the patient or their employer, if it's an employer purchase plan, a discount if the provider is actually paid less. So, it's a difficult position to argue, but I'm not aware of any discounts that are being given, and yet the insurance companies presumably are saving money.
Thank you very much for indulging me.
Welcome.
Thanks for the answers. I appreciate it.
Thank you guys very much.
Thank you.
Can we have David Reinhardt, Tom Hope, and John Powell now? We're looking to try and get somebody on the phone. I don't know how that's working. You're first in line.
Oh, I'm glad to be first in line. Good afternoon, Co-Chair Greenlick and Thompson, members of the House Healthcare Committee. For the record, I'm Dave Reinhardt, representing the Oregon Society of Clinical Social Workers. And I am here today with a heavy heart, not simply because I'm in the same panel with the insurers, which we're generally not in the company of, but
please ignore the chaos up here.
Is this Dr. Keepers?
Yes, I'm right here.
Okay, you are live, so if you have background noise, if you'd please put it on mute, and then Co-Chair Greenlick will call you when it's your turn, and you can listen in the meantime. Is that okay?
Sorry, please. Yes, I'm with the heavy heart.
I'm here with the heavy heart because we would rather not be here in opposition to a rate reimbursement parity bill. And yet 4010's special deal for nurse practitioners, we think, fails to address the larger problem that affects all non-physician practitioners and runs counter, we believe, to the clear charge that this committee gave the Oregon Nurses Association and Regents in the 2011 legislature. As you recall, there was a rate reimbursement parity bill that covered a number of disciplines. It didn't go anywhere in the 2011 legislature because there was worry on the part of some who testified on a race to the bottom. And Co-Chair Thompson gave clear direction to the industry, to the Nurses Association, to the Oregon Society of Clinical Social Workers to get together, work together, and come back with something that would work for all of us. We were ready to do that. The Oregon Nurses Association was supposed to take the lead in that along with Regents. We heard nothing for quite some time until this bill that's presently before us started to get noticed. We actually had reached out to the psychiatrist who had opposed the 3028 in the 2011 legislature. We offered a possible compromise that would take care of the problem of a race to the bottom. We actually talked to Regents about that. But here we are today. We received no consultation with the Oregon Nurses Association, and we now know why. We don't think this is the way to go because it is not a holistic approach. It is not the kind of approach that Representative Thompson and others wanted at that time. And so we are reluctantly here today to oppose this because we just don't think it's a solution that works for everybody. And I will point out, Ms. Morley referenced the rate cuts she's experienced and the income cuts she has experienced. Our people have had those same kind of rate cuts, and one of our members has seen a 37% drop in his income. Thank you.
Questions? Yes.
And this is not. This is for the chairs, actually. I've heard this a couple times, and Dave, you and I've had the conversation. Was the onus on wrangling up the parity conversation, was that the onus to do that on the nurses? Did you task them, or did you task everybody to come together to do that?
Fortunately, you mentioned your name and not mine.
I honestly don't remember. It was the intention that they would all come together and work on this as an informal work group. I can't say that I didn't task the Nurses Association to lead the effort, but I don't recall either way. The idea was they were all supposed to come together and work on this problem and report back. That part is consistent.
Okay, because, I mean, I've heard that and a couple times.
You guys get together and straighten this thing out.
Well,
yeah, but I guess my concern is that what I've heard a couple times is that, you know, nurses, this is your job to go be the wrangler and make this happen, and I don't remember it happening that way.
Yeah. We did not appoint a formal work group. It was a, you guys go away, solve this problem, and come back to us, and we didn't appoint any legislators to this.
And I think that's still out there.
An industry issue. Had we appointed legislators to it, I'm sure it would have been clarified miraculously. I retract that statement.
All right. That was my so my question was to you all, because I honestly don't recall
that
anybody was specifically tasked to do it.
I'm not going to put anything on the record.
Yeah. Mr. Chairman. Mr. Reinhardt, I think.
Yes, I remember very distinctly, and I'll tell you what happened. Co-chair, Thompson made his statement to the nurses and the insurers, and as a representative of the OSCSW, I was very concerned that we wouldn't be in that game. I passed a note to Representative Thompson at that time, asking him if we could be included in these discussions. And
that's true.
Right.
Yes.
Can I follow up then?
Yes.
So did all the alphabet soup in this building? I'm sorry. Did the OSCSW, did you guys either reach out then during the summer to Regents, or did you reach out to the nurses? I never heard from anybody outside of the nurses all summer long.
I didn't follow up, so I accept some responsibility in that part of it. When we turned it loose as an industry work group, I didn't do anything.
I guess I have concern that, and you know, you and I have had this discussion, I have concern that if there was some work to be done, and it was me, and I was in your chair, I wouldn't necessarily wait around for somebody else to come and engage me. And I don't know. So I'm curious what the engagement process was on your part to move the dial forward on that conversation.
Representative Parrish, members of the committee, I did, after a while, I was not hearing from either Regents or the nurses about this. They are the big dogs in this fight. We are kind of a little puppy, although we do cute work. And after a time, it became apparent that there wasn't any consultation, and I thought, I have members that are very interested in this, and I had a possible solution to it. So I went to the psychiatrist, as I said, who had been the primary opponents of the bill along with Regents, and said, would this kind of thing work for you? Would this approach that I had outlined and I won't burden you with today? They said, yeah, this is something. And
we need to move this on.
Sure.
First, Co-Chair Greenlick, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Tom Holt, Director of Legislative and Regulatory Affairs for Blue Cross Blue Shield of Oregon. I'm here today on behalf of the 730,000 Oregonians we serve as a not-for-profit insurer. I want to first say this bill is not about whether or not we or anybody else likes nurse practitioners. We happen to think very highly of them, and we would like our members to utilize them more when it makes sense to do so. You know, we would like to see our members use nurse practitioners, if that's their choice, for primary care and other routine services, just as we would prefer that they use a specialist when they need specialty care. We don't want cardiologists doing annual checkups, and nurse practitioners probably shouldn't be practicing cardiology. But where it makes sense, they have a really good role in the system. That said, this bill very plainly would increase health care costs. None of our members came to either of the two rate hearings that we had this past year and said, we would like to pay more premium so that these people can be paid more money. No one showed up for that. We prefer to work collaboratively with providers across the state, and this process that we're all engaged in trying to change the healthcare system to look beyond fee for service and to look at how we can have creative arrangements with providers that result in even better quality of care and reduce the rate of increase in the costs in the system. We've had a lot of success in that in the last year or two in particular. This year we rolled out into the marketplace a plan and option in the Portland area where we have many provider networks that can compete against each other, where we can offer a cost differential that's very substantial versus the traditional preferred provider organization broad network base, and people can choose whether they want to go that direction or not. When we achieve those savings, contrary to Ms. King's assertion, we do pass those through to our customers and our members. We just went through a rate hearing where we went to the insurance division a quarter, 3 months earlier than we needed to in terms of when the rate would be up for review, with a reduced rate for our small group members because, one, we had experienced less cost increase than what we had anticipated in the prior year, but also looking at what's developing in our contractual arrangements with providers, and the hope that, and the prediction by our actuaries that the cost curve is getting better. This kind of bill ties our hands to be fully engaged in the reform efforts that I think we all support to attempt to bend the cost curve in healthcare. We don't pretend to say that costs can necessarily be cut tomorrow, but what we can do is reduce the rate of increase very substantially. We don't think it's productive to enshrine in statute something that's really attached to a fee-for-service system that everyone hates, and we know is a driver of very severe increases in costs and affordability over the last number of years. You know, if we're going to change from that system, then we need to have the flexibility to be able to do that. Just the last point I'll make on this is we've also heard testimony that somehow there's an access issue as providers are required to compete harder to get our members' business. It's simply not true. We did a deep examination late last year. I want to say earlier this year, but we're just in February. It was toward the second half of last year, where we looked specifically at our mental health care networks, and more broadly at primary care networks. And the question we asked is, are we seeing, as we engage in these new kinds of arrangements of shared risk and asking people to really hold the line on their costs, are we seeing people having to bail out of our networks? Answer is no. Did we have any complaints from providers about their rates and saying, you know, I'm going to have to leave your network because you're not paying me? Essentially, no, with very few exceptions. So it's, you know, we think we're on a good trend in getting our hands around the rate of increase in cost of health care. We would much prefer that the legislature not take action in this area, as we and others need maximum flexibility to engage in creative win-win situations with providers. These conversations today are not about piecework, what the fee for a specific service is going to be. It's more about what kind of level of quality can a provider deliver, what can they do creatively, in some cases to share risk with us and our members, and to get a better result at the end of the day. With that, I'll stop, and I think John Powell can address some of the technical aspects that we have concerns on with the bill.
I have a brief question. It was in recent memory that Blue Cross Blue Shield reduced the parity between nurse practitioners and physicians in primary care and other areas, as I remember. Do you remember what the rate increase was following your reducing the parity? It's not a trick question.
Co-Chair Greenlick, I don't know offhand what those numbers would be, but what I can tell you where we did make a change was in the Medicare space, where CMS put out new guidance that is essentially mandatory for us to follow in our Medicare Advantage business, to have an 85% ratio to for nurse practitioners to physicians. And we followed that in that portion of our business.
And, you know, as to other providers, as you heard earlier, it's a negotiating process, and, you know, as they compete, some are more, some are less. I'd be happy to dig out and provide to you some of the trend information on rates and when rates changed.
Mr. Powell?
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair, members of the committee. My name is John Powell, also representing Regents Blue Cross Blue Shield of Oregon. Mr. Chairman, our co-chairs and members, I believe the earlier discussion about the bill being limited to standalone nurse practitioners drifted from the words on the paper. And the words on the paper say if you are certified or licensed as a nurse practitioner, that the reimbursement will be equal. So this would not apply to standalone only nurse practitioners. And I believe that the bill could be read to say that if you are a mental health nurse practitioner, you'd be paid the same as a psychiatrist. And we had a hearing last session on the mental health nurse practitioner rates. I would imagine you all would not have remembered that hearing as well as I would, because two practitioners followed me and said that the rates that I had given, that Regents pays them, were inaccurate, that they didn't get paid near that much, that they would love to get paid that much. So after the hearing, I said, well, that's very important to me because I don't give that information to committees. Within 24 hours, I received emails from them apologizing because indeed those rates were what they were paid. So I think that sometimes the people talk about 20%, 30% reductions. That's definitely hasn't, I don't know where those kinds of losses in revenue have come from recently. And Regents had a payment for mental health nurse practitioners that, and for mental health in general, that was far above any other provider. And a few years ago when those rates were reduced, we were still the second highest paying provider at those rates. So I do think that the bill applies to any nurse practitioner in any setting.
Any setting that you reimburse for nurse practitioner services.
Right, yes, and absolutely. That would include the clinic situations that have been talked about before. And the issue came up about standalone HMOs, and I do not know whether they pay in salary a nurse practitioner the same as they pay a physician. I would doubt that, and I don't think I would doubt that medical clinics that hire physicians and nurse practitioners pay equal, but I could be wrong. Thank you.
Thank you. Yes, sir.
How many?
My twin was first.
Your finger was first?
Okay. No, you were first.
Okay. And I've got a quick question. I think, and this goes back to the hearings last time, it seems to me that part of the reason this has been brought to people's attention is that physician's assistants and nurse practitioners' rates were lowered. Am I mistaken by that?
Yes, they
okay.
were.
Lowered. Have you guys raised them back up to where they were?
Have they raised them back up? No.
Okay.
I mean, the fact is...
No, it was a short answer.
Yeah, that was my question. Thank you.
Conger?
Four questions?
How about three?
I only have one.
Three, you got
it's
it.
A hard
see,
one.
I should have asked for five.
He's an attorney.
Let's see if we can move on quickly.
So, absolutely, I will try, but I'm going to ask the same question. This is for the insurers. Are doctors in the same community paid differently depending on what's negotiated with their specific practice setting?
Yes, of course they are. We ask them to compete against each other, and where a group of physicians can deliver the same quality of service at a lower cost, then we like members like that to happen.
I think that's not a fair answer. I think the question is, do different insurance companies have different reimbursement rates for physicians?
I meant the
that's
same
correct.
Insurance company.
But generally speaking, Regents will pay all your physicians in Bend that are in private practice. basically the same rate. Is that not right?
Co-Chair Greenlick, that is no longer the case. That's one of the things that we have worked with providers to change in the system. They want to show value to our members, and we want to deliver that. So we do see physician groups in the same community that are at different prices relative to each other.
Yeah, physician groups. But you wouldn't tell me that 12 independently practicing physicians in Bend have a different reimbursement agreement with you, would you? Yes, it would, a large clinic might work out a deal with you. But you don't individually negotiate rates with individual fee-for-service physicians in communities.
Co-Chair Greenlick.
Plus, life has changed dramatically in the last 2 hours.
I think that would be an unusual case.
It would be a very unusual case.
So the nature of the question, just to be clear, and I'm actually picturing a real-life situation in Bend, Oregon, so it's one community, but within about a six-block radius, you have a large clinic, you have a hospital, and you have a two-doctor family practice, and for the primary care physicians in each of those settings, you could have a different reimbursement rate under the same treatment code.
Co-Chair Greenlick and Representative Conger, as you described, one kind of on its own small practice versus a group, you could see different costs. You may see a range of in the marketplace of anywhere from 80% or so of the market average to some who want above average, and of course we aren't too anxious to pay above average.
Moving along quickly then, do you have contracts then typically with all of the providers in your network? In other words, you're reimbursed if you have and I assume in-network and out-of-network, I mean, that's the way I look at it as a consumer. I assume that's a meaningful term when you're negotiating with providers. Are you entering into contracts for the rates that you will reimburse them?
Co-Chair Greenlick, Representative Conger, I think the short answer to your question is yes. In terms of in-network versus out-of-network, that's more of a member-facing kind of issue, and that in terms of the out-of-pocket cost is going to be different. The provider is going to be reimbursed probably differently out-of-network. There are a number of advantages they have to being in-network versus out-of-network as a provider that go beyond the reimbursement.
But the contract question, the answer is?
I think yes.
You think yes.
If you can rephrase your question.
Are you entering into contracts with providers that run for a certain period of time?
Yes.
The reason I ask that question is because if this bill went into effect, what happens to the contracts that you have existing with providers? Do you go renegotiate them? Are they for a year? Are they for 2 years? Are they for a month? I just don't know the answer. I'm just asking.
Yeah. Co-Chair Greenlick, Representative Conger, I mean, that's a key issue with the emergency clause. Any change that we are required to make or wish to make on our own in contracting has a long runway. We have to wait for the renewal process to come along and work through that. If it's some other kind of system change, there's other things besides the provider. There's IT systems.
I'm really getting worried about this.
You're looking at a 3 to 6 months kind of runway for many changes.
I think it's fair to say you could figure out how to work if this bill passed and not.
Co-Chair Greenlick, I think in my short answer would be it would be almost impossible for this to do it on day of enactment as an emergency clause required. Could we respond as what would then be a new law require? Of course we could, over a period of time.
Exactly, which is the way it always works, right?
Yeah.
Wouldn't work any different than this one. I mean,
So I only have two more.
Please, we really do need to move on. We have lots of issues today, and we have only another 40 minutes.
I appreciate the indulgence. One is, actually, this is more of a comment. So the only other question I have, let me make my comment so I don't get cut off. Primary care and psych access, you said there's not a problem with that. That flies in the face of everything I've seen and heard from providers out in the marketplace, as well as my own experience as a consumer in finding out that people are primary care physicians are often not taking new patients. And so it is a comment, not a question. I'm not accusing you of being untruthful, but I want to tell you that I view that statement with a lot of skepticism based on my own personal experience. The question that I have is, and this is a point that I think Mr. Powell raised, how does this work in the context of capitation? Do you have any capitated arrangements now with providers? And if you don't, are you going to? How do you see this fitting into that, if it's relevant?
Co-Chair Greenlick, Representative Conger, if you don't mind me responding, let me very briefly respond to your comment. I didn't mean to imply that there's not an issue generally not having as many psychiatric and psychological providers across the state as what many of us would like. My point was that in terms of our networks and our ability to service our members, we see our networks as being very adequate, and we're not having any complaints from our members or from providers of an access issue of that sort, where a provider saying, "Hey, I've got X number of your members, and you're."
I'm going to interrupt. I have to close this. We have several other witnesses to testify, where we have four other bills to deal with in the next 45 minutes. So, I'm going to excuse you and ask for the next panel to join us. Thank you very much. Why don't we take testimony from Dr. Keepers on the phone, and then I'll ask Mary McCarthy, Lisa Trussell, and Kelsey Wilson to join us at the desk. And Dr. Keepers, if you're ready, could we try and hold things from now on to about 2 minutes in discussion, please?
Dr. Keepers?
Yes, I'm here.
Please go ahead.
And introduce yourself for the record, please.
Yes. I'm Dr. George Keepers. I'm the chair of the Department of Psychiatry at OHSU, and I'm speaking as asked by the Oregon Psychiatric Association. Co-chairs Greenlick and Thompson, thank you for the opportunity to speak to the committee. I'm sorry I'm not able to be there in person. I will keep my remarks brief because I know that you are pressed for time. There are a couple of issues that I think it's important for the committee to consider in regards to this bill. The first of these is how it relates to our attempts to reform health care. I know all the committee are familiar with the triple aim of reformation in health care: to improve the health of our population, to enhance the patient experience of care, and to reduce, or at least to control, the per capita cost of care. And I would ask you to consider whether this bill is relevant to any of those aims. Because if it is not, it really isn't relevant to what we're trying to do with health care to reform. The second area that I would ask you to consider is the effect of passing such a bill at this time, when we are on the cusp of a very significant change in the methodology of provider reimbursement. We are now in the United States, following other countries, moving to the ICD-10. And the ICD-10, the International Classification of Disease, the 10th edition, will have a very significant impact on how healthcare is reimbursed. The ICD-9 is a relatively simple classification of diseases, diagnoses, and conditions, which has been expanded in the ICD-10 to include much more detail about the conditions which are being treated, their severity, the place in which they are being treated, and other factors which may strongly influence whether reimbursement is given and also the amount of reimbursement. We do not know at this point in time all of the impacts of the conversion to ICD-10. There certainly will be a lot of unexpected impacts from it. For example, there is not a direct correspondence between all of the ICD-10 codes and all the ICD-9 codes. One consequence that will probably be intended is a finer method of deciding what is reimbursable and at what rate, so that conditions which formerly were classified together will be split out by severity and by type of condition in a way that will allow payment that is more appropriate for the actual condition that the practitioner is treating. I think given this really sea change in how healthcare is being delivered and how we are reimbursing it, that this is a relatively difficult time to provide appropriate legislation such as this for the reimbursement of healthcare, despite the fact that I'm quite sympathetic to the very legitimate complaint that the nurse practitioners have had in regards to having their rates cut by insurance companies. I'll close my testimony there and take any questions that you might have.
Thank you very much, Dr. Kuiper. Sounds like one of the problems we have now is differentiating what's really being treated might be alleviated in ICD-810. On the other hand, just as a physician, you have to deal with the patient where they are, even when science isn't ready for that patient to get perfect care. We have to deal with legislation at the time we have. And can't wait for the perfect time frequently, but thank you. Okay. Thank you very much for joining us, Dr. Keepers.
Thank you, Co-Chair Greenlick.
Who's next?
Chair Greenlick and Chair Thompson and members of the committee.
2 minutes, please.
Pardon?
2 minutes, please.
2 minutes? Okay. Thank you for allowing me to testify. My name is Dr. Mary McCarthy, and I'm a member of the Oregon Medical Association Executive Committee. I'm also a practicing psychiatrist in private practice in Portland, but do consulting work for Oregon State Hospital and the Department of Corrections at a prison here in Salem, and travel to Tillamook Family Counseling 2 days a month to do work there at Community Mental Health. I'll just emphasize several points that other people have brought up, and you have materials from the OMA that you can read for more detail. First of all, nurse practitioners work along with us in many settings. I have two settings I work in where nurse practitioners work. They're a very valuable part of the healthcare team, and patient care they provide is important to ensuring access to healthcare for all Oregonians. The OMA agrees that the current reimbursement model is broken. However, payment reform should not be carried out in a piecemeal fashion, as already pointed out by several other people today. We're concerned that the House Bill 4010 will result in insurers cutting the current commercial rates paid to physicians rather than increasing rates paid to nurse practitioners. And if that happens, this will make recruitment of physicians to Oregon a further problem, especially in psychiatry and child psychiatry. The OMA has met with the sponsors of the bill and are continuing to work with them and would like to offer an amendment, which you have information about already. So what I'd like to say in summary is that we oppose this bill without the amendment, and that the solution does not work for everyone, as was pointed out by Dave Renard of the social work group. Do you have any questions for me?
As I say, we don't have an amendment before, so if it can be amended, we can pass it on to the Senate, and that would be a place to amend it. Thank you very much.
Yeah, we've not received a copy.
Oh, I'm sorry.
I thought
that
I'm sorry. I don't know what you speak of.
Okay. Well, one of the staff.
There is a proposed amendment, I think, that was discussed in the back.
I'll see you.
Yeah. And it's the same as in the Oregon Academy, the letter.
Oh, it's one of those two options
it's
presented.
Those two.
Thank you.
Okay.
Chair Greenlick, Chair Thompson, and members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to testify today. For the record, my name is Kelsey Wilson with Gallatin Public Affairs and representing the Oregon Business Association. OBA is opposed to House Bill 4010. OBA's healthcare agenda this session is focused on the exchange, transformation, and cost-saving measures within the healthcare system. We are concerned about the impact of House Bill 4010 will have on this effort. OBA supports practitioners practicing at the top of their licensure for the lowest cost to policyholders possible. House Bill 4010 doesn't get us there. By requiring parity in payments, the incentive to use lower-cost providers is diminished. OBA opposes House Bill 4010 because of our concerns about costs and encourage you to consider the impact on premiums to individuals and businesses this bill could have if passed. Thank you for the opportunity. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you very much, Ms. Wilson.
Co-chairs and members of the committee, Lisa Trussell representing HealthNet Health Plan of Oregon, and also here in opposition to House Bill 4010. And there's a couple of things that I think have been pointed out. One is, the bills before you, do they increase cost or reduce costs, or do they do nothing to cost? Some of the bills will have no impact. But the issue isn't so much about cost for our company, because if a nurse practitioner applies to be credentialed as a primary care physician, we'll reimburse, and we accept, and we're able to credential them, we'll pay them as primary care. Nurses that don't contract with us or who contract just as nurse practitioners, we pay them at a nurse practitioner rate. For non-contracted nurse practitioners, our company several years ago went away from usual, customary, and reasonable and started using Medicare plus a differentiator. I think in our case, it's we pay Medicare plus 60% or something like that, or 160% of Medicare. That's it. And so because Medicare pays nurse practitioners in the category of something called allied professional rate, that's 85% below a primary care, we take that as the rate and then we pay accordingly. 85%
of a primary care.
Right.
15% below.
Right. And so it's just, it's something that at some point we can build it into the rates if that's what you choose to do. But as it's just something that right now, and it's already one example's been given, we think there's other providers who bill with codes that doctors use that would, probably be able to say the same thing, pay us as an MD or a DO. So for those reasons, we're opposed to it.
Thank you very much.
Mr. Chairman.
Yes, sir.
I guess maybe more just a comment.
Right. While you're commenting, can I ask Jan Meekum and Betsy Earls to join us?
That'd be great. I guess what I find reprehensible in our discussion or in the process is that we're talking about the reduction of rates.
Mm-hmm.
That's the piece that I find disagreeable. And I thought it was interesting in the testimony by the psychiatrist that they wouldn't like physician rates reduced. And I guess I don't blame the nurses for coming and asking for relief. Because I suspect if physicians were being reduced in rates, that they would be there. And I think arbitrary rates without explanations are pretty unreasonable. So just to be clear about where I might be.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairs, Mr. Co-Chairs, and members of the committee, for the record, Betsy Earls representing Associated Oregon Industries. AOI has about 1,600 members across the state. Those members employ about 200,000 of the state's employees or the state workers in this state. So we very clearly represent the people that were referred to earlier, the purchasers of private health insurance. Our premiums are going up, as you know, dramatically every year, and small businesses have been struggling and will probably continue to struggle to maintain coverage for their employees. Because of that, we have been looking this session and last session and even before that at ways to increase efficiency in the system and save costs to the extent possible, or at least flatten out cost trends. This bill goes directly in the face of that effort. Any increase in reimbursement to one particular type of provider will go, as one of the carriers pointed out, directly into our bills, which we pay for premiums. So although we understand all of the agonies of reimbursement cuts to providers, any arbitrary payment parity legislation such as this, which brings up reimbursement payments for one or a group of practitioners, is going to increase our premiums directly, and we oppose the bill for that reason. Thank you.
Thank you. You are the two first people in on the list on 4164. Both hearings are open now. Do you want to do 4164 while you're sitting here?
Why don't we have Jan do this one and then...
I'll be very quick.
And then we'll go back.
No, great. Give me a minute to get ready.
Go ahead.
Okay. Co-Chair Greenlick, Co-Chair Thompson, and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Jan Meekums, the State Director for National Federation of Independent Business, Oregon, NFIB. We have about 350,000 members nationwide, and we continually survey them. And continually, one of the number one concerns that comes up is health care for themselves, their family, and their employees, and the rates that continue to go up, sometimes 20-25% annually, if not more. And as has been stated before, there is a lot of attention and effort on the part of the legislature and of the public and the business community and insurers to bring down costs and maintain costs. Like has been said before me, we are concerned that this will increase premium, increase delivery, and diminish the incentive to go to alternative lesser care. And for that reason, NFIB is opposed to 4010.
Thank you. Representative Kennemer.
Mr. Chairman, just if you indulge another sort of comment, a number of people have testified about their concern that this will increase costs, and at some level that is somewhat true, but the reality is we're talking about rate reductions. There was parity in pay, so actually the costs were the same. And so what we're really doing is we're reducing costs by reducing provider reimbursement on a select group. That I find unacceptable. I don't think that that constitutes increasing the costs. I think we're trying to maintain what was the cost while we try to figure out what in the world to do with a crazy system that all of us know is broken.
Mr. Cameron, why don't we hold this for the debate?
I'm sorry. I just...
And I won't confuse you. I will call you back. Let's close this public hearing. And
Okay.
I want to make sure you're fully heard on the next bill, which is equally important. Thank you very much. I will close the public hearing on House Bill 4010 and open up a work session on House Bill 4010.
That's correct.
And that's prepared for a motion, yeah. Mr. Co-Chair.
Thank you. Chair Greenlick, I move that House Bill 4010 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Thompson moves House Bill 4010 to the floor with a due pass recommendation, and we are now open for discussion. Representative Kenny Geyer, I know you've been chomping at the bit.
I'm trying to learn the process here, so I didn't want to go out of turn. So several people in this audience who I've talked to know that I've had a lot of questions about this, and I've been trying to get up to speed, and this is the one that's kept me up at night more than any other issue that's facing us, with all the big issues facing us. I think it's why a lot of people said, don't go on the health care committee. So it's really a hard one. I want to recognize that. And
We're delighted you're
Yeah. I'm questioning. But and I also want to recognize that in trying to learn about this issue, the incredible pain that I've heard from payments that have been cut. Sorry. To nurse practitioners, and I've seen what some of those rates have been between 2009, 2010, 2011, and I've also heard stories about how sometimes nurse practitioners running their own clinics will get a notice in the middle of December saying, as of January 1st, we're cutting your reimbursement rate to such a rate. And I'm very disturbed by those, and I absolutely want to be a part of a solution moving forward and to correct a situation that I think is really unfair, and it's a fairness issue, it's an access issue, it's a lot of different issues. But as of yet, I am not prepared to vote yes on this bill because I do have a lot of concerns, and so I'm putting it out there so that you all can respond, and if it's open back up to a public hearing, other people can respond to it too. First is a fairness issue. I've heard a lot about this issue referred to as equal work, equal pay, and the situation that I'm most familiar with is a constituent of mine who came and testified last year before the Senate Health Committee, Dr. Mike France, who's a child psychiatrist, and he talks about the 2 years of master's level training that a psychiatric mental health nurse practitioner gets compared to the 9 years that he had with 4 years of medical school. followed by 3 years of residency in psychiatry, followed by 2 years of a fellowship in child and adolescent psychiatry. And yet in that particular area, all the billing codes are the same. So I kept saying, you know, is there a way to change this in billing code so that when somebody who comes out with 9 years of experience and has done a lot of clinical hours and neurology and child development and real specialty training, when they do a diagnosis and somebody with 2 years does a diagnosis, is it really equal work? And so that's just been something that's really plagued me in terms of the fairness. You know, I think the nurses have a fairness issue, and I think people who have gone through 9 years of training have a fairness issue there too. And it's exasperated by the fact that the people that have had that kind of specialty have put a lot of money into medical school and have had loans and have not been able to earn a salary. And in addition to that, pay higher malpractice. So on a fairness level, comparing one to the other, it's really hard for me to say equal work, equal pay, and that's fair, and look people in the eye. So that's one issue. The other is just impact to the overall system, and what kind of system are we envisioning? And for that reason, I don't really have the answers, but the thing, you know, what I think about is a healthcare system where you've got specialized people that have many years of training at the top, and you don't want a lot of those people because it costs a lot to maintain those kind of people. And so you usually kind of, you might have that, and you have nurse practitioners, and you have other levels of nurses who currently are paid different amounts in a salaried level in a practice, certified nursing assistants versus registered licensed nurses versus RNs, paid at different levels because they have different training. And then you might have the community health workers that we're envisioning in a CCO model. So you have something like that. And a lot of the way you drive that higher cost care, the specialized care that takes more training, is because you do it by scope of practice, or you do a different billing code so that only the ones that are trained can actually do the, you know, neurosurgery or something like that. That's kind of how we do it. But when we've taken, when we have a progressive policy, as Oregon does, in part as a response to open up access because we have a lack of mental health practitioners, we're opening up access. We have a progressive policy. We're allowing nurse practitioners to do all the same things that psychiatrists have done. You take away that incentive then to use people at the very top of their license. So I'm concerned about the implications of paying everyone the same, and what does that do to the overall system? In addition, David Reinhardt, I think was the name, brought up a situation that I know many of us have gotten lots of letters from clinical social workers saying, in the mental health parity, why aren't we a part of the conversation? So you might chalk it up to me being new on this committee. I've spent a lot of time trying to understand this issue, but I do feel like we're approaching it piecemeal. This is a really big issue. I have seen the amendment that Oregon Medical Association put forward that is also in a letter that was passed out to us by the family physicians, that suggests at the very least to give relief to what many see as injustices, arbitrarily lowering the rates of nurse practitioners to the point where it's really hard for a lot of them to keep their practice open, that we should go back to where it was in 2009. I want to find a way to be a part of a solution in this. I want to find a way to yes on this bill, and as it currently stands, cross the board, parity, not taking into account differences in training, other in primary care, specialty, subspecialty. I am not there, but I would love to see an amendment that would allow us, you know, to rectify a situation and then perhaps have a work group in the next year to really look thoughtfully at this.
Thank you very much. Representative Parrish?
Thanks. This is not typically the type of bill I would support, truthfully. Doesn't kind of go in my nature. And but a couple things. I mean, first of all, I appreciate that all of you all come out and you sit in these hearings and you come to healthcare and you pack the room, and that's all well and good. I also serve on Veterans Affairs. That room is typically empty. None of you typically are there. And for a certain class of people, for me, in my mind, we've got folks who are soldiers in this state who live in rural parts of our state for whom access to primary care and psychiatric care is just mission critical, and we don't have enough providers in the field to serve these folks. So for me, while this kind of is a bill that would typically go against my nature, for me, this is an access issue. When I hear from soldiers who come to me and say, I'm struggling to, and granted, these are part-time soldiers who are not getting TRICARE, so they are typically employed by folks who are, you know, private health insurance, and they may or may not be service-related, but when they live out there in Ontario and when they live out there in different parts of the state, you know, for me, where is their voice in this thing, in this conversation? And you all don't don't come to those committees and hear from the handful of people who come up and tell us that mental health care and access to primary care out in, you know, far corners Oregon is a huge critical concern for them. And so for me, this, like, while this is typically not something picking winners and losers that I would support, nurse practitioners in my mind are a scarcity in our state. And when you're talking about on the other side of the mountains, and we got people out there who clearly need access, for me this is an access issue, and trying to hopefully maybe incentivize some of the access to go out and practice in those far corners. I've got a guy who just graduated nurse practitioner and is willing to do telemedicine out to far corners Oregon to try to, you know, provide service to those types of individuals. And so when I hear the conversation on the other side of the room, when I'm over in Veterans Affairs and it's not filled with a bunch of healthcare folks, you know, it's concerning to me that we still have these huge access issues, and part of it is around not having enough providers and having incentive, and physicians too as well. Same conversation is going to apply there, but that's, you know, that's my big concern, and that's why I have given this a lot of thought, and like I said, not typically something I wouldn't support, but I'm going to be supportive of this on this one.
Representative Doherty?
Quickly, we don't get legislation unless there's a problem. There wasn't a problem 5 years ago, but the rates were not lowered. And so it's just kind of a little bit of a foresight. We do need to look at health care, and we need to look at health care where lines are going to start to blur when it comes to what people do. But I guess it's a little bit of a warning down the road. Don't go through and take one group of people and lower their rates, or two groups of people and lower their rates, and then expect not to hear from them later on. And so it's just kind of a warning thing. I agree with Representative Parrish. Nurse practitioners, physician assistants play an extremely important role in the metro area, but especially in the rural areas where physicians aren't. So it's just a little bit of a warning. Not that we don't love to hear from all of you, and we want all of this big process, but sometimes problems are created, and so maybe sometimes we have to think twice down the road.
Thank you. Senator
Conger? So I agree with everything that's been said. I think there is a problem. Part of the problem probably stems from the way that insurance companies are signaling reimbursement rates to nurse practitioners and others. I think that these are problems that should be addressed. Unfortunately, I don't think the bill as drafted does it, certainly not with the clarity or the degree of detail and certainty that we as a legislature should be passing on to both providers and payers. And so regretfully, I won't be able to vote yes on this.
Thank you. I support this bill. I feel very strongly about it. I believe it's an issue of equal work for equal pay. By statute, we've defined nurse practitioners having exactly the same obligations, responsibilities as physicians in virtually every place they work. I am convinced as long as they are legally equal, and unless there's some other way to differentiate severity or whatever else they do, I think they should be paid the same as physicians. That's different than other professionals, and that's why we have to deal with these issues separately, although we need to deal with fair pay for other health professionals. I'm a PhD, and I've spent about 50 years studying health policy, which I would argue the same way the child psychiatrists argue. I should be paid more for sitting here than all you other guys who are kind of new to the field.
We should pay more for having to listen to you.
You have to put up with me, and that's combat pay, so there are various pieces of
some of us should have pay reductions for the amount we talk. So.
But the fact, I mean, that's obviously a ridiculous argument, but in some ways it's not ridiculous. In some ways it's the same. You have a PhD physicist working as a programmer on a rocket project because that's the job they have and that's the job they want. You don't pay them more because they're PhDs in physics. You pay them whatever is the proper pay for the job they're in, and I think this is the issue here. So I am very pleased. I will support this bill. I'll close the debate and ask for... I didn't know you were there. You got perfect. You would have been first, sir.
I get that a lot.
Normally,
I only support perfect bills that perfectly solve problems.
Me too.
But unfortunately, in this business, I think we have to fix things as they happen in incremental portions. And I think that's what we are sitting on here. I'm disappointed we didn't get where I wanted to get from last session. We need to go back and re-examine that. And not just for the issues on the table. We have an even larger issue, and that is, how are we going to apportion the workload between professionals throughout Oregon, and particularly in rural areas where we are resource poor? In the last 2 years, I have lost two psychiatric nurse practitioner clinics from my district, two practitioners each. I have two nurse practitioner medical clinics that are solo practices that are on the rocks over this issue. And it's a matter of access. We have to have a system that will allow appropriate access into healthcare. We heard testimony before this committee that with the Affordable Care Act, we're going to increase the Medicaid population in Oregon from 550,000 to something like 950,000. We're not doing a really great job, especially in rural areas again, of covering the 550,000. I can't imagine if we don't find some level of parity for practitioners in a lot of ways that we're going to be able to have a modicum of access for the 950,000. Practice extenders, wherever we can develop them, are going to be the rule, because we can't get MDs and even nurses in the numbers that we need to go where we need to go. I'm going to support this bill today, but it's with the sort of warning that we had better get ourselves organized on this transformation plan and come back and look at this overall workforce issue. We don't have the workforce, especially outside the urban areas, that can deliver the services that we need. And it's critical. In my district, I have no physicians that will accept any more Medicaid or Medicare patients. That's over reimbursement. I have clinics going out, as I mentioned, going out of business, and have gone out of business because of the cost of doing business against their reimbursements. That's not the philosophy nor the direction that we said we're going to go in Oregon with transformation on the access end. I understand this might cost us some money to do this, but it also level load the system a little bit more. So I'm going to support this bill today, not because it's the perfect bill, but because it moves a little bit in what I think is the right direction. And hopefully we'll use this as a springboard to pick up more of the outliers that we need and get proper support for them. We'll have that discussion in an upcoming meeting. But we have major problems in providing health care access over the next couple of years here in Oregon. And this bill barely scratches the surface, but I think it moves us in the right direction. So I'm going to be supporting it.
Thank you. Debate's over. Would you please call the roll?
Representative Doherty?
Yes.
Do I get to vote? No.
No, you don't. Not if you're a no vote.
I see how this works.
I'm sorry.
Yeah.
Are we still going?
Yeah, please say, I'm sorry to interrupt. Go ahead.
Representative Perry?
Yes.
Vice Chair Boyle?
Yes.
Vice Chair Kinnemer?
Aye.
Co-Chair Thompson?
Aye.
Co-Chair
Greenland? Aye. You got everybody?
Yeah.
Motion passes. I'll carry it on the floor. And I'm going to carry over right now the public hearing on House Bill 4046 to Monday and House Bill 4127 to Monday. Public hearings and possible work session will be carried over to Monday on those two bills. I'm going to open a public, the public hearing is open. I'm going to return to public hearing on House Bill 4164 We have just a few minutes. I'd like to get this public hearing closed. We'll then move, carry over the work session and move to a work session with invited testimony only for Monday on this bill as well. So I would like to call, I think, three remaining witnesses, Jan Meeker, Betsy Uro, and Mike Becker. And Rick Bennett as well. We'll have four. We have about 10 minutes, so that tells you what your limit is. Make a strong, strong statement, but make it quickly. Please start.
Mr. Co-Chairs, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Betsy Earls, representing Associated Oregon Industries on House Bill, supporting House Bill 4164, the business plan for the exchange. AOI very much appreciates the work that the Exchange Board did over the interim to develop a business plan. And I'm sure we all remember working on this bill last session. We had a lot of fun, didn't we? And when we worked on it, there were a few specific things that we wanted to see in the business plan. The first and most important was that we wanted an easy-to-use system that allowed employers to make one defined contribution for their employees to the exchange and write one check, which would then be taken by the exchange and divided up among whichever plans their employees chose. And, you know, on the other side of that, we wanted employees to be able to have an easy-to-use system that they could find the best plan, the plan most suited to their needs within the exchange for the money that their employers were spending and any money that they chose to add to it. We think the business plan meets that need. We also wanted to see an opportunity for employees who might have more than one job to aggregate contributions from multiple employers in order to purchase their own health insurance plan. And the business plan also meets that requirement. And one final thing that we wanted to see and had in the bill was a dual market so that health insurance could be purchased, for now at least, outside and inside the exchange. That was very important to us because we support the exchange. We want it to be used by our members and to grow, but we want it to do that because it's attractive to our members and to their employees, not because they're forced to use it. And our position is that having the opportunity to buy outside the exchange or inside the exchange facilitates that type of growth. I think the final thing I would say is that we wanted a strong opportunity for competition within the exchange for health insurance plans. And the way the business plan's written right now, it also allows for that. So we're very supportive of the business plan. Thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Good afternoon again, Co-Chairs Greenlick, Co-Chair Thompson, Vice Chairs, and committee members. For the record, my name is Jan Meekums, State Director for NFIB Oregon. I, like Ms. Earls, have been before you many times in the last year regarding this bill, and NFIB likes the bill that is before you today, and it does, as was already communicated, embrace the elements that we feel are very important for our small business members. And rather than reiterate those points that were just made that we support, I just would like to add also that the importance of this bill is the fact that it fits the timeline that will allow Oregon to have a tailor-made for Oregon-only exchange, rather than risk having imposed upon Oregon and a federally designed bill. And for that reason, NFIB is very supportive of House Bill 4164. Thank you.
Co-Chairs Greenlick and Thompson, members of the committee, my name is Mike Becker with Providence Health and Services. I've handed to you today a copy of a letter co-signed by Greg Van Pelt on behalf of Providence Health and Services and by Jack Friedman on behalf of Providence Health Plans. And we're here today to offer our support for the legislation, HB 4164. We think the exchange is an important component of healthcare transformation and reform. It will make it easier for individuals and small groups to purchase coverage. It will stimulate fair competition. We think the structure recommended in the business plan ensures choice and innovation. And we would strongly urge your support for that business plan and passage of this bill. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Any questions? Thank you, panel. Mr. Bennett?
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, Rick Bennett, Director of Government Relations for AARP Oregon. I'll be very brief with consideration for your time. You may recall last session AARP expressed some concerns about the legislation that created this exchange, but it is law, and we want to do everything we can to support the work of the exchange board in moving this forward and creating the exchange and getting it up and running. As I testified before the board a few weeks ago, we believe that there is significant benefit both to individuals and to small businesses that we'll see from the exchange. And we've also expressed to the board that AARP is willing to assist in any way we can, both related to community outreach at the appropriate time and in any other way we might be able to support the board's work. So we support the business plan and we support House Bill 4164. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Mr. Bennett. We will close the public hearing on House Bill 4164 and carry over a work session on House Bill 4164 to Monday, where we'll have invited testimony only. I'm sorry for folks who came to testify on the last two bills. An over-ambitious agenda, as I'm afraid we're going to have on Monday, Wednesday, and Friday of next week. So please be prepared to be a little flexible as we try and do the work we have. We have only until a week from Monday to finish all the House bills. So we have now less than 8 hours more to go. I think we're going to be a little tight.
Somebody behind us needs the room.
Any other comments? Good job on that debate. That's our first split vote.
I think so, yeah.
We're adjourned.